Did the office employees union have other places organized, or was it primarily just other?
No, no, they had they had private contracts. Mm-hmm. You know, in San Francisco, the San Francisco union really had a very bad time organizing. They never really got off on its feet. Organization-wise, the Oakland local was the most successful outside of New York and other big cities. It was the most successful organizing union that I've ever known. You know, and they've got thousands of members, and they've got hundreds of contracts. You know,
what,
in the Oakland area,
but
San Francisco.
More successful than San Francisco?
I don't know. I don't understand that, because San Francisco is one of the best union cities in the country, you know. But that local in San Francisco has had a very hard time organizing. But, of course, they've got all of their union offices organized. But that's hardly enough, you know what I mean? They're supposed to organize private industry. And to my knowledge, they haven't done much. I receive the Office Employees International newspaper from New York or wherever, it's Washington, D.C. And I've never, very seldom have I ever seen that local 3 in San Francisco mentioned in the paper. Mm-hmm. Even Los Angeles has a tough time, but it has a much, it's much more industrious organizationally than San Francisco.
Now, you in the union, you didn't hold any
views
on the board.
No, I didn't. No, except I was sergeant at arms for a few years. But I don't think I was in San Francisco. I was a little too radical for them. But one of the problems that I had was arguing with some of the employers. And this would be the union employers, too, you know, and breaking some of the union clauses in our contract, you know. And unfortunately, the business agent we had didn't like my arguments. You know. And I said, well, what on earth did you do when you were not a business agent and you worked in union offices where they were breaking laws? Because I kept my mouth shut. And I thought that was the most outrageous answer that I ever received. You know. And we had quite a bit of problems in that union in San Francisco, because when I joined it, it was already in the CIO. It had broken away from the AFL and went into the CIO and organized pretty heavily, organized some big unions, some big industries. You know. And then we had trouble with the communists in that local, and that's when Bridges would come down every now and then, you know, and talk to us. And the Sailors Union of the Pacific was very interested in our fight with Bridges, because they were also having a fight with Bridges, you know. Yeah, incidentally, is a very interesting story, because we were forced to split away from the CIO. We were forced to make overtures to the AFL to return to it. And we were finally granted permission to do so.
What was the point of that?
The point of that was that the communists were so powerful, and with Bridges coming down there and telling us to toe the line or else, that we had to make a choice, you know, either we or else we split. And the only thing we could do if we split was to go back into the AFL.
So it was actually to form like a splinter union off of the employees?
It was actually a what was that?
A splinter union that was another, formed?
Well, it was another split in the office employees union.
But some of them stayed in the CIO?
Some of them, those who were sympathetic, those who were communist and sympathetic to the communist members stayed in the CIO. They were taken over by the warehouse men.
I see. So but they were no longer called the office employees then?
Well, no, they called themselves something else, and I should remember that, because They were in the Warehouseman's Union under that name, and I can't recall it. You could get that information.
But the office employees kept the ones who went into the AFL.
Kept the name.
And kept the local
and
number.
The others called, and no, they got another local number. They couldn't keep that CIO local number. But the worst of it was at the first meeting we had, Vanderloo, I think, was there. He was the state chairman of the AFL. And Bill Becker, have you heard of him? Well, he was also quite active in the AFL, but he was also either an anarchist or a socialist. That's why I thought you might know him. They were both there at that meeting, and Vanderloo started to lay down the line to us. He might just as well have said, says, you toe the line or else. He sounded just like Bridges, and you can imagine how we felt, you know. My God, from the frying pan into the fire, you know. And we were really very glum about the whole business. We didn't know what to do. But this Bill Becker was very sharp. He saw our attitude, and he got up and he corrected Vanderloo, you know. He really did, you know. He said, well, it isn't, he says, I don't think that we ought to put such demands on a new local. And after all, they're repenting, they're all split off from us, and they've broken with the communists and Bridges, and our attitude should be a more tolerant one. So that gave Vanderloo the clue, and he just, I think it was Vanderloo. I always get mixed up with Vanderveer.
Oh, yeah,
and Vanderloo. But you could get that name correctly, too. See.
How large was the group then that split off?
Well, we must have been... God, it's hard to remember. Because we lost some members. We lost the contracts, you know, after that split. And we didn't lose them to the CIO either. They just simply quit the union altogether. Well, it must have been several hundred of them. But how many were the four or six? Perhaps about 600.
When did the split occur?
In 38.
Oh, so it was right after.
Yeah. See, I came there in January, so during that year it split. Mm-hmm. You know, and it walked off with all the furniture and all the money and all the records. You know, it was a real thieving job. But we felt quite justified in doing that. Because we really represented most of the members in the local. I don't know, I think they had about, at the most, 800 members in that local. And we took about two-thirds, more than two-thirds of them, 75% of them. And we felt that we were entitled to everything we had before, to the furniture, to the money, to the records, and to the members, you know. But we lost several hundred members after that. Those are the one contract in one company. We had about 200 members. You know, it was a large one. And again, my memory is very poor. It was something like Safeway, but it wasn't Safeway. It was a San Francisco supermarket.
Now, were the majority of the people in this union were women, I presume?
The majority of them were
now, some. Was there any difference in the split in terms of who were the communists? Were the women equally involved in both? Or were the communists...
Well, there were both men and women involved in the split. We had a number of men, but we had a majority of women. Mm-hmm. I know one man that I've known for several years, you know, and have never known him to be a member of the Office Employees Union, comes to one of our critical meetings, and when the vote was taken, he gets up to vote with the communists. And I was just burnt when I saw that, you know. I objected to it, and I called attention to the chairman, or the chairwoman, you know, that man was not a member of this union, that he may want to be a member of the union, but he's not a member, and that he cannot vote. We were at that time splitting our heads over votes, you know. because we wanted to win. I don't remember who won, but we wanted to win. I had turned anti-communist by that time, really anti-communist, when I saw how they were operating, you know. Perhaps, just, you know, I thought that our faction operated far more honestly and certainly more seriously. But the communists, you know, were using some very peculiar phrases. All they wanted us to do was to sign a piece of paper. And I was incensed, you know. That paper had words on it and sentences and ideas. And we disagreed with the ideas. We disagreed with every word in it. Because how can they just say that all we had to do is to sign a piece of paper like it were a blank paper, you know. Anyway, that was the beginning of my knowledge of how the communists really operated. And I must admit they were very successful. They were successful for a number of years in San Francisco while I was there. But I begrudged them the success.
Were the other people who were in the splinter group you were in, were they radical, or were you one of the
radicals?
Oh,
yes. We had socialists and Trotskyites in there. And then we had some Democrats and a lot of liberal people in it, and some conservatives. It was a combination of all political ideas. You know. And I don't think that, for instance, when this big market, when the girls in the market split away, just split from the union altogether and remain independent, they were regretful. But they just couldn't take any more quarrels, any more arguments, you know. Of course, they impoverished us terribly. The business agent and the organizer and the union was paid by the, either by the county or the state, by the state AFL, and they were paid $10 a week, I believe, $50. God, that would have been big wages in those days, during the Depression, towards the end of the Depression years. And then we had many volunteers, and I was one of the volunteers. When I didn't work, I used to go there and answer the telephone, do office work, whatever was required. And there was always plenty of work in there. So that was my activity in the union.
So, and then those 10 years...
And, let me see. I'm trying to think. I'm trying to gauge now the split between the original organizer and business agent and the new office, the official force that came in, and I can't recall it because I was in San Francisco at that time from 1938. For about 11 years, or 10 years, 10 or 11 years, and I moved down to Los Angeles, either in 48 or 49. But during that period, we had other business agents, and we had quite a, I was, we had quite a fight in that union. I know the business agent wanted to expel me, and we had an international interview of the whole business.
You don't remember what that fight was over, though? That was after the split.
Oh, that was quite a few years after the split. And there were several of us. She wanted to expel some four members, and I was one of them. And it was on the basis of positions, you know, on certain decisions, you know. And I think it was political. So that when they had a committee, a reviewing committee there, and they talked to each one of us, they just couldn't see any reason to expel us because we had not broken any of the union regulations. It was mostly our political ideas, and one of them was to expel the business agent. So before we did that, she wanted to expel us, you know. Oh, that was really quite an exciting period. We had a lot of excitement in the union. We had it up there, we had it down here.
So you were quite very active in the union.
Yes. Well, in that sense, you see, I was always active in some degree or in some regard mm-hmm. in the union, both in San Francisco and in Los Angeles, because as I said, I belong to the top official corps, whether I was an official or not, you know. Nevertheless, I was always in on anything new that took place, you know. And wherever I was permitted to go, I went. And I was active in that sense, you know. And also active in some things I didn't understand, you know. There were certainly political machinations in that union as well as in the Democratic Party and the Republican parties, you know. And I couldn't understand them. But to any degree that I understood the arguments within the local, I would take a position on one side or the other. And I was always with the liberal side of it. Because our business agent kept calling the union a business, and I couldn't accept that. I argued with that very severely. I said, a union is not a business. A union is a beneficial association organized to benefit its members. You know. And if you don't benefit the members, then you are not. Then you are neither a union nor a business. You know. Oh, she used to get very angry. She was quite angry at me throughout almost the entire time that she was business agent. But at least she wasn't business agent forever, because we had another one, and that one is still business agent, and that's really almost 20 years. It's amazing. Well, she's a capable person.
Now, then what brought you down to L.A.?
On what grounds I left? Oh, I don't know. I got very tired of the San Francisco climate. You know. I was getting 2 or 3 colds a year over there, and the rains were tremendous. The fog was intolerable, and the wind was very ungodly, I must say. Oh, the wind was terrible in San Francisco. And then I came down for a visit, and I kind of liked Los Angeles. And then, of course, when I came down for a visit, I met a lot of people, a lot of Wobblies especially.
In
48. So I decided to move down here, and I did. And I went to live with a Mary Gallagher.
Oh.
Mary Gallagher was very active in the Tom Mooney Defense and the sharecroppers years ago and so on. And through her I met, I don't know, dozens of people. And I kind of liked it, so I stayed here. But I went back in 1952 to San Francisco. See, I mean, I've been really, I should have double citizenship, because I go to San Francisco at least once a year. And I've been going to San Francisco every year ever since I moved down here. And I'm planning to go again in May. And maybe I'll move back there and try to endure the climate, whether I like it or not. I can't stand the heat here in summer. It's too much like New York City to me. And I couldn't stand that heat, you know.
Well, how long did you live with Mary Gallagher then?
Oh, I'd say several months. Because she had a rooming house. And I didn't actually have a room there. I just slept first in the living room, then in a part of the kitchen, just slept in her room, but she was quite a wine drinker and snored terribly, and I couldn't stand the snoring, you know.
And what kind of work were you doing there?
I was working in the union office.
What union was it here?
I wouldn't say the leather goods. Sometimes I think I'm going to die losing my mind.
It was in one of the related to the clothing industry, though.
No, it wasn't. You know, I think, did I ever work for them, or did I apply for a job there and couldn't take it? I think I worked for them for a few. I worked in San Francisco. I worked for the Ladies' Garment Workers Union, and that was a good job. But I couldn't. The people were terrible. The workers were really terrible.
In what way?
Well, you know, they say, "How much money are you getting?" And I tell them, "That's too little." So I say, "Well, why don't you get up there on the floor of your membership meetings and insist that I be paid more money?" And I was already paid above the union scale. And then they were always complaining about their job and about the secretary and about Jenny Mathias. I don't know if you ever heard of Jenny Mathias. They were complaining of everybody working in the office, and they were never doing anything about it. So, and it was a... I also had personal problems during the period that I worked there. And finally, in the end, I quit. You know, it was just too much. And then I got a job working for the operating engineers. That was the loveliest job. The loveliest job was working for the Marine Cooks and Firemen Union. But working for the operating engineers was really funny, because that was a temporary job, supposed to last a month, and I worked there 8 months, and I could have worked there permanently, except that that was a job I left to come down to to Los Angeles. But the girls over there decided that I would be the spokesman for all their complaints on the job. So I said, okay. And Victor Swanson was the secretary then. He was a very nice man, but like all business agents, they say that he defrauded the union out of so much money, and he was given a jail sentence, you know. He was arrested, really, and given a jail sentence. And so we had meetings with him. He had a very high regard for me. I don't know why, but when we have these meetings, I couldn't get the girls to bring out their complaints, you know. And I'd look at them, and I couldn't understand that. So he said, "Well," says, "what's the problem, girls?" So finally I told him, I said, "Well, the girls have sort of chosen me to be their speaker on this. And since I know what the problems are, do you mind if I mention them?" He says, "No, not at all." And so I did. And it was I don't even know what the complaints were. I don't even know if they were legitimate. But he said, "Well, we'll have another meeting on this." The next meeting came over with figures to show how many rest periods we had. And there were supposed to be 10-minute periods, and we often took half-an-hour periods. We had an hour for lunch. We very often took an hour and a half for lunch. We had so many holidays a year. We had from 1 week to up to 3 or 4 weeks vacation a year. And he said that from the amount of money that you're getting more than any of our operating engineers an hour are getting. So you're far, far higher paid than our own members are. So tell me now, what's your argument? And the girls couldn't say a word, not a word, you know. So he told me afterwards, he knows, I appreciate your speaking for the girls. But they really were getting an awfully good deal over there, I'll tell you that. That was a very good office to work for. You know, we used to stand in a long hallway with rooms, one behind the other, and hallway with no doors in between. We used to stand there and talk while work was during the working periods, you know. And nobody told us anything, but he told us. He says, "Now," he says, "I've never complained about you girls standing in the hallway and carrying on a flippant conversation." And he says, "I've never complained about you getting in a huddle someplace or having your birthday party and your anniversary parties and your showers and so on and so forth." He says, "I've never complained." He says, "So girls, what are you complaining about? I'm paying you the union scale, and actually you're getting more than my own men are getting." So, but the reason that I remember how well he thought of me was that one year when they had the convention, the state convention here in Long Beach or Santa Monica, one or the other. I went there with a blind man that I knew who wanted the AFL to help the blind get certain conditions. So I told them, says, I know some of the men, I know some of the people in the executive committee, so let's go down there and get a hearing. So we went down there, and at that time, Joan London, did you know her or know about her? She was the daughter of Jack London, and she worked for the state AFL for many years in the I don't know, she gathered in the research department. And she, at conventions, she took all the resolutions that were sent in and compiled them, and compiled all kinds of things to send them to the printers to have ready for the next day to be placed on the table for the delegates. Have you ever been to an AFL convention? Well, it's very difficult to explain to you the setup. But anyway, we went there and we got a hearing. The executive committee was glad to give us a few moments. So we went into that room, and the minute Victor Swanson saw me, he gets out of the chair, walks all the way over to me to shake my hand. Now, I call that the real chivalry thing, because very few people, there were others there who knew me, and none of them got up and said, how do you do, Mrs. Kettler? None of them said anything. So anyway, we got that hearing, but I always remember that about Victor Swanson, that he had this high regard for me, which surprised me. See, the trouble is that I never did know my own abilities, you know. And of course, I worked at the wrong end of a union. I should have been working out in the field, you know, not organizing. If I learned how to speak, I could have done organizing, because I've talked to many girls, you know. And every time I talk to them, you know, girls who would attend meetings, girls that I work with in offices, and they'd say, oh, says, you can't get anything through in the union meetings. Says, you just go over there and you listen to a lot of junk, and you go home and you can't, and they won't listen to your complaints. And after I talked to them, they changed their views, and you know, a lot of them regarded me as their speaker. The same thing has happened in San Francisco. So it is quite possible that if I had retrained myself in that department, that you wouldn't be taking my biography now. I might be writing my autobiography.
Now, when you came to L.A. then, you continued to work in unions?
Yeah, I worked in unions all that time, except once. That was just a bookkeeping job in a private business.
And then you went back up to San Francisco in 52 for how long?
I was there about a year and a half. I worked in unions then too.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I've put in very little time working in private business, working for private businesses.
And then you came back here and continued to work
To work in unions, and I worked until I retired.
And when did you retire?
I'm trying to think of the date. At 65, 12 years ago. About 11, 12 years ago. So. I was tired of working. But boy, I've never been so tired of my retirement as I am now.
You got a pension from the union then?
No, we didn't have a pension plan then. You know. They have a pension plan now, but it's very recent. It's about 5 years old.
Now, when did you become involved in the current women's movement?
In the what?
In the current women's movement.
Oh, about 2 years ago. I don't know why, you know, for instance, some people would try persuade me to join the the Women's Voters League. And I couldn't do it, you know, I just couldn't do it. It felt like a foreign element to me. But I went with a friend to the NOW organization about 2 years ago. And then I used to attend all their meetings. They had them at the Joe's, a chicken restaurant on 8th in Vermont. They had a room in the back, a large banquet room there. So we used to eat our dinners there and then hold our meetings there. And I think that I attended about six of those before I joined, about 6 months before I joined.
And that was in about 1970 then?
It must have been, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I got known almost right away. It's always my way, you know. For instance, the first time that I went in there, I told the woman who was at the desk giving out literature to people as they came in, and giving them the tags to put with their name to plaster on their coats or dresses. And I told her, I said, you know, I spent 30 days in jail for the vote. She says, you did? I says, yeah. You know, because this is how I connected the mm-hmm. National Organization for Women, as a continuation of the voting struggle. And then this, it took several months, you know, it took a long time for it to really penetrate to the membership. And it didn't penetrate until, when was it we had that big march? 71?
No, that was 70. August 26th.
The August wasn't 70?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
it was
then
for the 50th.
Then I joined it in 69.
So you'd been involved before that big celebration.
I was a member at that time. That was in August 1970. Mm-hmm. Is it really that 2.5 mm-hmm. years? It's difficult to believe. Well, I was a member then in 69, and maybe even in 68.
Now, how did you first happen to go to that first?
Well, a friend of mine, a member of the Socialist Party, told me about it, and I said I'd like to go, so she took me the first time, but after that I went on my own.
Now, you were probably one of the few women of your age, weren't you?
There were very few. I think there might have been, at that time, there were more women of my age than there are now. The women of my age seemed to become disgusted with the sexual concentration of the NOW organization. And it was much more concentrated then, you know. I mean, that they had a play about it, most of which I couldn't hear. My hearing is very bad. And this woman, who must have been in her 70s, got up and she said, can't you girls think of anything else but sex? Since this whole meeting has been devoted to sex, and I think that's filthy. Well, boy, you know, you can't imagine what it did to us. You know, we tried to pacify her. And it is one of the things that I fought against my whole life. My mother and father also told me that sex was filthy. So I never suspected that they had sexual intercourse because it was filthy. I couldn't imagine them going through a filthy act, you know. So it was years before I learned that it wasn't filthy, but it wasn't spoken about. But in the meantime, I'd formed so many ideas about sex that it was really interesting. The hypocrisy of parents towards their children in regard to sex is ruinous, absolutely ruinous. But when I found out, I gave my mother such a ball out that she cried. She just cried. I said, my God, I've asked you so many questions. She says, well, I thought you'd learn. I said, learn where? Well, in the street, see? Like my sister did. See, my sister was about 3.5, 4 years younger than me. She was about, when I learned, I was about 15. My sister was either 11 and a half or 12, you know, and she learned it already, and I hadn't even known how our children were born. I thought that was very cruel, you know, because one of the issues that disturbed me very much was what they used to call in those days the loveness, you know. Now, I thought, if sex is dirty, why do these loveness come into existence? Why do people persist doing a dirty thing. I couldn't understand that. And I began to question the truth of my mother's words. You know, my father was already dead then. So it took me some time, you know, to really recover from that. I belonged to the Labor Temple in New York, to the Girl Scouts and to other organizations. I was active in that Labor Temple. And I know that when I heard that, the first thing that I asked the teacher who was in charge of us, or the, what do they call the, not, they're not called teachers, what are they called? The woman who, well, the Girl Scout leader, or I think she was some other, she was something else besides. But she was a certified teacher, however. So I asked her that right in front of all the other girls. And poor thing, she blushed, you know. And she said, I'll talk to you afterwards. Do you mind? I said, no. Just as long as I, my mother's words were verified. I wanted to verify all the stuff that I heard out in the street. And she told me afterwards that it was true. And I said, well, why isn't it told to children? Well, it's a very delicate subject. We can't discuss it. We're supposed to know about it, but we're not supposed to talk about it, and stuff like that. But that was the beginning of my development. Boy, I tell you, before then I was a child.
So you really reacted to this woman getting upset at this whole thing, at this now meeting then?
Does that what?
At that now meeting.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, I wasn't upset. I thought, my God, you know, is it possible that people would come to the now meeting and still hold those views? But it wasn't, I don't think that she considered it dirty, really, but she considered it as an extraneous subject, an extraneous activity. Although that is not true of the now movement. The now movement takes a special interest in sexual freedom. And they just don't have those kind of old women anymore. If they do, they're like me, you know. They recognize that we've been sexually maligned, as well as mistreated. You know. That we want the right to understand sex, and then to use our own option as to whether we want extramarital relation or whether we want premarital relations, but to at least be given an education in birth control and against venereal diseases and so on. I've always been very open about that subject. Always been open about sexual subjects.
Now, what kind of activity did you get involved in them with now? Just going to the meetings?
Just really going to the meetings, because I couldn't, you see, all of those girls, most of those girls, have cars. They can go here and there. They don't need to exercise their feet. On the other hand, my feet hurt very badly. I have no car. If I go to a meeting, I have to go out in the dark. And the city has become dangerous in the dark. It's dangerous enough during the day. And I mean, I'm actually infirm in that regard. Also, my eyes are not very good. I can't go to the headquarters and spend some hours there answering the telephone and meeting anyone who may come in during the afternoon or during an evening. I just can't go any place. If I go to the meeting, I have to beg a ride from somebody.
But you're quite committed to that.
I'm committed to now, yeah. I'm committed much more to now than I am to the women's liberation movement. Because I met some communists, the Women's Liberation Union. And I'm telling you, I got frightened about them, although this is very foolish of me, because I really don't have any fear of them. I mean, I recognize them, but I don't have any fear of them. But the Women's Liberation started out, in my opinion, badly. But they're recovering from it now. Now, it may not be the Women's Liberation, but it may be certain members in the Women's Liberation. But they started badly in the sense that those were not the important issues. to me, they were very basic discriminatory issues that we have to fight. And whether you wear a bra or don't wear a bra is immaterial to me. It's healthier to wear a bra, which was discovered in modern society, than it is to let it move up and down, which may cause a breakage of some of the muscles if you're too heavy, or cause other disruptions in the breast, you know.
There are
certain things like that, and then also the freedom of using four-letter words, and I have no objections to them except that they are misused. They are meaningless, you know. We have some very good words in the dictionaries that mean much more than those four-letter words. And I've had a certain objection to them from all my life, for the reason that they're used without discrimination.
Well, what do you see the goals of the current women's movement being?
The goal of the current women's movement is to get all the clauses within ERA passed. Mm-hmm. And it'll be a piecemeal struggle, absolutely piecemeal. For instance, the inequality in wages is the worst of anything I've ever heard. Because to me, the worst of anything that I have great objection to is the intellectual inequality between the sexes. I mean, the fact that the male brain is more equipped to think than the female brain. And you meet so many men and so many women, you find them both ignorant, you know, and you're not equipped to talk to either one of them, and they are not equipped to carry on a conversation with anyone who's had some education.